Hello and welcome. On behalf of CME Outfitters, I would like to welcome and thank you for joining us for episode two of the CMEO cast titled Exploring Innovative Treatments, Appraising Novel Pharmacotherapies for Narcolepsy. The podcast series is supported by an educational grant from Avadel CNS Pharmaceuticals. I'm Dr. Anne-Marie Morris. I'm the Director of Child Neurology and Pediatric Sleep Medicine with Geisinger Jenoise Children's Hospital in Danville, Pennsylvania. Today, I'm joined by my esteemed colleague, Dr. Cleet Kushida.
Hello, I'm Dr. Cleet Kushida. I'm a neurologist and professor and serve as Division Chief and Medical Director of Stanford Sleep Medicine.
Thank you so much for joining me today. I think this is going to be a really exciting conversation that we're going to have about this huge explosion of treatment options available in the landscape for narcolepsy. So with that stated, our first learning objective is to learn about the latest clinical trial data for novel pharmacotherapies for narcolepsy to differentiate among mechanisms and formulations. So Cleet, let's get started with a quick overview of the signs and symptoms we see in narcolepsy. We recognize that we have two forms of narcolepsy, type 1 and type 2. And with that, we can see that there may be variability in the presence or absence of some of these symptoms. So help me unpack a little bit about not only the PENTAD symptoms that we typically are quoting, but some of the other features that may be present in these conditions.
Thanks, Anne-Marie. So the key signs and symptoms of narcolepsy type 1 are cataplexy, which is a sudden decrement in muscle tone, typically triggered by sudden emotions such as laughter, anger, surprise. There's also excessive daytime sleepiness, sleep paralysis, and hallucinations. Sleep paralysis and hallucinations typically go hand in hand. And an example is, just one of my patients who she would start to fall asleep, be paralyzed and see her husband come in and he would have a knife. It was actually a hallucination, but she would be paralyzed at the time. And you can imagine how terrified she would be. So all four of these signs and symptoms are present in about 42% of patients with narcolepsy type 1, though not all occurring initially. Narcolepsy type 2 has these signs and symptoms with the exception of cataplexy and patients, although they have sleep paralysis and hallucinations, have them to a lesser degree compared to those with narcolepsy type 1. Other symptoms are things like fragmented nocturnal sleep, REM sleep behavior disorder, and sleep drunkenness, which is like confusion upon awakening. Also long nocturnal sleep time and napping, which may occur in patients with narcolepsy type 1 and 2, but in varying degrees. And it's estimated that only about a quarter of individuals who have narcolepsy have been diagnosed and are receiving treatment.
Yeah, and I think that part of the things that may contribute to that is the variability in which you may see these symptoms. So although some epidemiologic data has suggested up to 42% of individuals will have all of these symptoms, it's important to characterize that it may not all be at the same time. And so 100% patients are always going to have excessive daytime sleepiness, most sensitive symptom. Every single patient has it. But I think one of the newer kids on the block that is really being recognized as a really impactful symptom is that fragmented nocturnal sleep or disturbed nocturnal sleep. And the way that I kind of look at disturbed nocturnal sleep is also that it's pivotal in looking at those other REM dissociative features. So whether it's nightmare disorder or REM behavior disorder or sleep paralysis or sleep-related hallucination, because we're seeing that with that disturbed nocturnal sleep or fragmentation, you're also seeing the fragmentation of REM sleep and allowing for some of these other symptoms to be introduced and really can be a very, very problematic symptom and frequently gets misdiagnosed as insomnia. I don't know how many patients you've seen who come in with that disturbed nocturnal sleep. They clearly have symptoms of narcolepsy, but they've had a pre-existing diagnosis of insomnia because of that sleep fragmentation.
Yes, so that sleep fragmentation and disrupted nocturnal sleep is something that's typically been overlooked for a long time in patients that do have narcolepsy. But you know, just talking with patients, you can really unpack that and get the sense that it is something that is one of the more difficult symptoms that patients with narcolepsy have, and it causes them much distress because it causes them to not feel very rested during the daytime and also feel like they can't get a decent night of sleep at night.
Yeah. And I think in this table, it is important to recognize that some of these features are present in other hypersomnolence disorders like idiopathic hypersomnia, specifically those long nocturnal sleep time and sleep drunkenness. And it's important to note that although it can occur in narcolepsy, those are typically atypical for narcolepsy in compared to idiopathic hypersomnia. And so I do think that those are important to recognize that they're not distinguishing factors of narcolepsy and actually may be more common in something like idiopathic hypersomnia. Let's go on to see what else we have to unpack here today. So when we're looking at the clinical trials and really trying to understand the information that's available to say which medications may be the best for the person in front of me, it is important to understand what were the measures of efficacy that were used in these clinical trials. So, Clete, why don't we walk through some of these tests that are used or assessments that are used and really better understand maybe why they're utilized or how they may be helpful in individuals who have narcolepsy to understand how severe their symptoms are.
So in clinical trials on narcolepsy, there's both objective and subjective measures. One of the more frequently used objective measure is the Maintenance of Wakefulness Test, or MWT, and it really assesses the ability for an individual to remain awake. And basically, the person is in a semi-darkened room, sitting up on a bed, and basically instructed to remain awake during up to 40-minute trials that can occur four times a day to measure their ability to remain awake. Now, subjective measures include the Clinical Global Impression of Improvement Scale and the Parallel Patient Global Impression of Change scores. And these are basically the first one is how the clinician rates or feels that the person is able to have improvement in their symptoms of narcolepsy. And same thing with the patient global impression of change. It's a patient's impression of how they are in terms of their symptoms. Weekly cataplexy attacks are typically measured by sleep logs or diaries that are completed by the patient themselves. And one of the more frequently used measures that is common in sleep clinic and laboratories is the Epworth Sleepiness Scale. It's called Epworth because it was derived by Murray Johns in Epworth, Australia. And basically, it consists of eight real-life situations, and the participant or patient is instructed to indicate zero is no chance of drowsiness, one is slight, two is moderate, three is a high chance of drowsiness, and is asked to put down either zero, one, two, or three for these real-life situations. And then it's totaled. And the maximum is 24, the minimum is zero. There's also other subjective measures that are frequently used in clinical trials, such as the narcolepsy severity scale, as well as the Swiss narcolepsy scale. So there's various types of measures that are used to assess the efficacy in these narcolepsy clinical trials.
So I think it's so important to understand what is being utilized and how it actually is reflective of real life practice. There's no one in clinical practice who necessarily is saying, what is the patient global impression of change or the clinical global impression of improvement? And so really recognizing that these are standard scales that are typically evaluated by FDA and do give some indication of directionality of benefit. And so they're very, very useful, but hard to extrapolate to what am I going to see on a day-to-day basis? Now, the Epworth Sleepiness Scale is one that I think in sleep medicine we're hotly debating as to how reflective actually is this scale. And so it's a validated scale and definitely the most widely utilized. In fact, insurances many times are mandating to see what is that scale saying in order for you to get the MSLT even approved or even sometimes some of these medications. Some of the things that's important is that you specifically had called out that this is a measure of what is your likelihood of dozing or drowsiness. And unfortunately, sometimes patients will misinterpret this as what is my likelihood to fall asleep? And the two are not the same. And so it is an important distinction to also, if you're getting a patient who's describing to you severe sleepiness, but their Epworth is maybe a five, making sure that they're answering the question appropriately and being able to utilize that perhaps more impactfully. The other piece that I think is important is that when we're looking at clinical trials, we generally are needing for patients to have a severe degree of symptom burden in order to be able to demonstrate statistically improvement. And so when we're looking at weekly cataplexy attacks, many times we see study designs that may include something like 14 cataplexies over a 2-week period. I call these types of things out specifically because it's important to take this information and apply it to your clinical practice and some of the barriers that you may see to being able to provide the best care to your patients. And so sometimes we may hear things like, this can't get approved because the patient isn't having enough cataplexy attacks because they haven't had 14 in 2 weeks. And recognizing that an argument there is really that this is not based on a clinical trial. This is based on the burden that the patient is experiencing. And being able to respond with information that actually may help you get medications that you think your patient may need into their hands. So some upcoming major clinical trials and investigational treatments for narcolepsy are really continuing to unfold and really starting to further broaden. Cleet, I reflect on the timeline I typically will see of the kind of drug FDA approvals since 2000. And for almost 20 years, we had seen that really you were limited in terms of the number of options you had for treatment. And now it is an explosion of not only different formulations of drugs that have been available, but also of novel mechanisms of actions coming onto the scene, including some of these major clinical trials like orexin agonists or once nightly oxybates, or even something like the extended release Mazendol, all representing potentially different ways of being able to treat patients. So help me understand a little bit around what are these different studies that are currently ongoing or potentially have been completed, and we're waiting just for some rollouts of information. And what can we take from this?
So one that's currently being tested and evaluated is a once nightly sodium oxybate. It's already been FDA approved and has an approved indication in narcolepsy, but there's an ongoing trial called RESTORE that's in phase three, and it's basically to evaluate long-term safety and tolerability and as well the ability to switch from twice nightly immediately release sodium oxybate to the once nightly formulation. There's also phase two and three studies to evaluate ATAC-861, which is an orexin 2 receptor agonist, as well as another study evaluating, or actually a series of studies evaluating Mazendol, which is a triple monoamine reuptake inhibitor and partial orexin 2 receptor agonist. There's also a phase three trial to evaluate reboxetine, which is a norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. The nice thing about these trials is it just shows, as you pointed out, that there is an explosion of new compounds that are currently being tested or evaluated as potential treatments for narcolepsy. And time will tell, how they stack up against each other.
Yeah, and I think when we're looking at these different options, it again is introducing the fact that these are all different mechanism of action, which is allowing us to also be able to treat individuals in a very personalized manner, dependent on not only what their burden of disease, but also their tolerability of these different medications. So some current FDA-approved treatments for narcolepsy are already on the scene. As I discussed already, since 2000, we have seen only an increasing number of agents becoming available, many of them focused on excessive daytime sleepiness, some specifically having an indication for narcolepsy, and a handful also being able to treat cataplexy. We see the majority or all, if not all of these medications have an adult approval. However, some of them also do have an FDA approval in pediatrics. Cleet, help me walk through and understand the utilization and kind of the medications that are listed here in this table.
As many people who have treated patients with narcolepsy, the amphetamines and methylphenidate have been around a while, and they basically enhance dopamine, norepinephrine, serotonin, and these are stimulants that are mainly used to treat the excessive daytime sleepiness of narcolepsy. Modafinil and are modafinil are dopamine reuptake inhibitors, and solriamfetol is a dopamine norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. And these are all so used to treat the excessive daytime sleepiness of narcolepsy. Pitolisant uses a slightly different mechanism. It's a histamine H3 antagonist, inverse agonist, and it's used to treat both the excessive daytime sleepiness and cataplexy in narcolepsy patients. And sodium oxybate, which comes in three form, which will be discussed later, is a GABA B agonist, and it's used to treat both the excessive daytime sleepiness and cataplexy in narcolepsy patients. And as shown in this table, for children, amphetamines, methylphenidate, as well as sodium oxybate are indicated, except for once nightly sodium oxybate, which is indicated for adults.
Yeah, and I think that really what we're seeing is the ability of not only a growing number of medications becoming available, but also with some of these medications having a novel mechanism of action, like the histaminergic agents, potentially being able to be collaborative with a lot of other medications, and definitely the oxybates as being medications that do have an indication for excessive daytime sleepiness and cataplexy. We do have experience with the twice nightlies in children, demonstrating significant safety and efficacy from 7 years and older. So really, again, having so many new options and only broadening the indications and also those who can be treated. When we're thinking about pitolisant, remembering that this is a unique mechanism of action, it's the only medication clinically available that actually has a histaminergic effect. The majority of our alerting agents are focusing on the dopamine system. It is important to look at what was the data that actually got them to FDA approval in narcolepsy, and how did it impact sleepiness and uniquely also cataplexy attacks.
So pitolisant was studied in 7 and 8 week randomized placebo-controlled trials, and they were called Harmony 1 and Harmony CTP for the assessment of excessive daytime sleepiness or cataplexy in adults with narcolepsy. And efficacy was assessed using the Epworth Sleepiness Scale and the weekly rate of cataplexy. The analysis population consisted of 61 patients in Harmony 1. It was 31 on pitolisant, 30 on placebo, and 105 patients in Harmony CTP, of which 54 were on pitolisant and 51 on placebo. Now, for pitolisant versus placebo, as shown in this slide, Cohen's D effect size were used. And Cohen classified effect sizes are classified as small, which is about 0.2, medium is about 0.5, and large is greater than or equal to 0.8. So the values that were in Harmony 1 were 0.61, and in Harmony CTP, it was 0.86 based on changes in Epworth Sleepiness Scale scores. And in Harmony CTP, it showed that there was changes in weekly rates of cataplexy, and that was an effect size of 0.86. So the results of this analysis demonstrate the efficacy of pitolisant for the reduction in both excessive daytime sleepiness and cataplexy.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that is not illustrated here, but important, again, an important clinical pearl, because I think the people who are listening to this podcast, they're trying to figure out, how do I take this information and apply it in a clinical setting, is that this medication has the impact on excessive daytime sleepiness, has the impact on cataplexy. We're seeing very robust number needed to treat and effect size. And one of the things that I think people sometimes don't appreciate is because it has a unique mechanism of action, and Kate, I want to hear what your clinical experience has been with this medication, it has a different experience for patients. And so typically, as we're titrating them over the course of several weeks, we're usually seeing this maximum benefit around 12 weeks, as opposed to kind of like the traditional stimulants and even some of the alternative alerting agents where patients will describe almost this punching you in your face, I'm awake. There's more of a subtle appreciation of, oh my goodness, my day has been extended without there being the sleepiness intruding, which sometimes can be missed because it's such a subtle increase that they're underappreciating until they're going, Wow, look at all that I'm able to do now, and it's 12 weeks later compared to 12 weeks ago. I don't know if you've had a similar experience in terms of.
Yeah, definitely. I have had that similar experience. It's very different from like amphetamines or methylphenidate, where you get that sudden, as you described, punch, in terms of alertness. It's more like somewhere between that and modafinil and armodafinil, where there's sort of like a gradual increase in daytime alertness over the day. That's the experience that most of the patients have reported to me. And also, in terms of cataplexy, it appears to be good in terms of also, treating the cataplexy as well. So you do get that dual action.
Yeah, and I think that's just important because sometimes people may prematurely think the medication is a failure and they may not have actually given it the right period of time for benefit. Now, another new kid on the block is solriamfetol, and tell us a little bit about the studies that was done and the data that has demonstrated the benefit. And I do think it's an important thing to call out that the FDA approved dosing at 75 and 150. However, the clinical trial actually included up to 300 milligrams. And even outside of the clinical trials, there's been some data that have looked at the impact of 300 milligrams with some substantial benefit, but unfortunately, risks around elevation in blood pressure limited it from being approved for that dosing.
Right. So, solriamfetol was studied to assess wakefulness and excessive daytime sleepiness in participants with narcolepsy, both with and without cataplexy. And this information was derived from a 12-week randomized double-blind placebo-controlled phase 3 trial. As you pointed out, participants with narcolepsy received solriamfetol at three doses. It was 75, 150, and 300 milligrams per day or placebo, and were stratified by cataplexy status. There were two co-primary endpoints. It was change from baseline on the MWT, Maintenance of Wakefulness Test, and the Epworth Sleepiness Scale. There were a total of 117 participants in the cataplexy subgroup and 114 in the non-cataplexy subgroup. At week 12, when they looked at least squared mean differences from placebo on change from baseline in MWT for solriamfetol, at 75, 150, and 300 in the cataplexy subgroup, the data was 1.6, 6.1, and 8.9 minutes, respectively. And the non-cataplexy subgroup, it was 3.4, 9.1, and 11.2 minutes, respectively. At week 12, the mean differences from placebo on the Epworth Sleepiness Scale change from baseline for solriamfetol at those three doses were minus 1.3, minus 3.7, and minus 4.5, respectively. And in the non-cataplexy subgroup, they were minus 3, minus 3.7, and minus 4.9, respectively. So the data indicate that solriamfetol was effective in treating excessive daytime sleepiness in participants with narcolepsy and without cataplexy. And this was indicated by effects on the MWT Epworth Sleepiness Scale score and the Patient Global Improvement of Change score. The safety profile was similar regardless of cataplexy status.
Yeah. One of the things that I find interesting about this study design and the inclusion of with and without cataplexy is that this is a mechanism of action that is distinct from modafinil and armodafinil, in that it's a dopamine norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. And frequently we'll reference that norepinephrine has a critical role in cataplexy. However, what was not quantified or had the study powered to study is the frequency of cataplexy. One of the other things that I frequently will reflect on, especially if I'm trying to get this medication approved and there's some delays, is that I'll frequently utilize another dopamine norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor, bupropion. It typically does not have the same benefit that solriamfetol has. However, it gives me some testing of the waters while I'm waiting to get that medication approved to be able to see is there any degree of benefit. It also makes me wonder as to whether or not solriamfetol poses some enhanced benefit in terms of mood regulation when thinking about the fact that bupropion is something used for mood. So I don't know if that's something that you utilize in your clinical practice at all or have considered in regards to the mechanism and the potential for benefit in cataplexy as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. There are patients that I've seen that have been on bupropion, for the other indications, which are things like depression. And interestingly, they have shown some improvement in their cataplexy, as well as I'm sorry, not cataplexy, in terms of their daytime sleepiness. But I've never really thought about it in terms of the comparison to solriamfetol, but that's a very good point.
So now to get into the sodium oxybate formulations. Now these are very unique medications. They're the only medications that we're prescribing to that are actually taken at night. And I always find it fascinating that this is a medication that is taken at night. It's out of your system by the time you wake up. Yet the FDA indication is for daytime symptoms only. It's for excessive daytime sleepiness and cataplexy. And so when we're talking about these oxybate medications, we're clearly talking about gamma hydroxybutyrate as the active component of them. And Cleet, I would love for you to give an overview of what are some of the things that these medications have been shown to be beneficial in. What are the differences between these three different formulations that we now have clinically available? And what's a REMS program, and how does that play into the use of any of the oxybates?
Yes, so as shown in this slide, sodium oxybate is the only medication that demonstrates efficacy across multiple narcolepsy symptoms, including disturbed nocturnal sleep. And as also pointed out, the pharmacokinetics, the elimination half-life is 0.5 to 1 hour. It was approved initially only for cataplexy, but was expanded in 2005 to excessive daytime sleepiness. And currently, the once nightly sodium oxybate is the only formulation not requiring a second dose nighttime awakening for narcolepsy treatment. You can see that on this, the three formulations are indicated for excessive daytime sleepiness and cataplexy, and sodium oxybate and low sodium sodium oxybate are indicated for greater than or equal to 7 years of age, whereas once nightly sodium oxybate is indicated for adults. The low sodium sodium oxybate we generally reserve for patients that have a history of either renal failure or congestive heart failure, or who have uncontrolled hypertension. The once nightly sodium oxybate compared to the sodium oxybate and low sodium sodium oxybate is the only one that's indicated for once nightly use.
So with the once nightly sodium oxybate, it is clearly having different pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics because with the twice nightly, it has that really short half-life. As you said, half an hour to an hour. So it's out of your system in 5 hours. So it really does necessitate that second dose. And I know that in my clinical experience that I have some patients who require as many as three doses. Or they'll have an initial sleep period and then they take their two doses just because the pharmacokinetics does not support them getting the full night's rest. Now, that's not everyone, but it is something that is unique. And so now this is a new formulation that has a unique proprietary mechanism that allows for there to be an extended release across the night. So what was the data that demonstrated that this was a worthwhile medication to come to approval?
Yeah, so we all grapple with the fact that for twice nightly dosing, it is not as easy for the patients because they have to typically time the dosing and set their alarm clock to wake them up, and that can be particularly problematic for adolescents, young adults who have more need for lengthier sleep at night, so their sleep debt might be a little worse than those that who are older. So the timing of that is important, and if they miss or have a delayed second dose, it can definitely carry over the next day in terms of the grogginess and also their sleep inertia. So the timing of the dose is very important. So once nightly sodium oxybate was shown to be effective on the REST-ON study for its effect on cataplexy, daytime sleepiness, as well as overall symptoms.
What's fascinating about the REST-ON trial is that we've now seen, with the explosion of number of medications that have come to market, some evolution in regards to what the FDA allows in regards to clinical trial design. And so we've seen some unique variations on clinical trial from what I think historically we all recognize as what we would call the gold standard, which is a randomized controlled trial. We've seen other trials that are much more, that are very patient-centered in being double-blind randomized withdrawal trials. But one of the things that is unique about this medication trial is that it was a double-blind randomized controlled trial with a forced titration. And with that stated, we saw a very few patients who terminated due to side effects, which is always a good thing to see. But we're seeing that there is sustained cumulative benefit over time in individuals who stayed in the trial. And as you mentioned, by week 13, very, very substantial, statistically significant benefit. And this was a pivotal trial that included both narcolepsy type 1 and type 2 and demonstrated substantial benefits in both populations, irrespective of cataplexy presence.
Right. And just to talk a little bit about this trial, it was a 13-week phase 3 double-blind multicenter study, and the subjects were randomized 1-to-1 on once-nightly Sotamaxolide versus placebo, and it was stratified, as you pointed out, for narcolepsy type 1 and type 2. How it was set up was there was a 3-week baseline screening period before randomization, and then they were initiated on 4.5 grams of once-nightly Sotamaxolide for 1 week, followed by 2 weeks of 6 grams, then 5 weeks of 7.5 grams, and another 5 weeks of 9 grams for matching placebo. And the baseline demographic and disease characteristics were well balanced between treatment arms. The mean age was approximately 31. The mean BMI was 28. About 80% of the participants were white, and approximately 80% had NT1. So for the MWT, at baseline, the mean MWT tested was about 5 minutes, indicating that participants were markedly sleepy. At the 6 gram dose at 3 weeks, participants stayed awake on average about 8 minutes longer than baseline. This effect was sustained, and they continued to improve with respect to sleep latency on the MWT, with participants staying awake about 9.6 minutes longer than baseline. And then at week 13, the change from baseline for once nightly sotamoxifene was nearly 11 minutes.
So we've talked about that there are some added benefits from having a once nightly sodium oxybate. Again, I want to say in full disclosure that there's not a one size fits all. And so having an increased number of options, my hope is that it only grows the number of patients that we're able to treat, not necessarily that there's only one solution. However, it is appearing as though that there is tremendous benefit with the once nightly sodium oxybate. And what's going to further inform on the once nightly sodium oxybate is the data collected from RESTORE. And so RESTORE was the continuation or the open label extension from REST-ON in evaluating this once nightly sodium oxybate. And this was specifically evaluating safety, tolerability, and patient preferences on individuals who were switching from a twice nightly sodium oxybate or low sodium oxybate to once nightly sodium oxybate. And so, Cleet, can you help me kind of just break down some of the data from this interim analysis on RESTORE?
Sure. As shown here, data were available from preference questionnaires with an N of 78 and nocturnal adverse event questionnaires of an N of 130 at the interim report cutoff in July of 2022. So a large proportion of participants preferred once nightly sodium oxybate over traditional twice nightly immediate release sodium oxybate, or identified the second dose of sodium oxybate to be inconvenient. Additionally, a majority of switch participants in the RESTORE study unintentionally missed a second nightly dose in the previous 3 months, and 80% who intentionally and or unintentionally missed a second dose felt worse the next day. And then out of 39 of participants who took their second nightly sodium oxybate dose over 4 hours after the first dose, more than half reported feeling groggy or unsteady the following morning. So some issues related to the second dose included anxiety, which was 29.2%, and the need to be awakened by someone, which is 23.1%. And lastly, within the past 3 months, 91% of participants arose from bed after waking up for the second dose. Nine of these reported having fallen, with five reporting injuries.
Yeah. One of the things that I think is an important take-home point, and so if an individual is listening to this and you're a sleep doctor and you're going, well, the majority of people who I see have sleep apnea, I see a handful of individuals who have narcolepsy. The story that is being described here is not unique to you. If you take care of patients who have obstructive sleep apnea, your goal every single day in seeing those patients is, how do I increase the adherence? How do I get every single night to be the same, because it dictates what the next day is. And we even see this now in regards to the battles between CPAPs and dental devices. And so what we're saying here is that if there's strategies that can be employed where you find that a limitation of the treatment for your patient is difficulties with adherence, simplifying the regimen so that there is a greater likelihood that all doses of all their medication is able to get in, it's only going to benefit the outcomes. This isn't unique to narcolepsy. We see this time and again. And I think that is just a really important call out, because many times that piece of information or how that practically can be incorporated into clinical practice sometimes gets overlooked. And so we've already alluded to that polypharmacy is extraordinarily common in patients with narcolepsy. This is like a disease process that affects 24 hours of their day. And so I don't know if you have some comment on just thoughts around the use of polypharmacy and some of the considerations.
Yeah, so it's always key to consider the patient needs and preferences, particularly with a lifestyle and substance use, taking note of the severity of excessive daytime sleepiness symptoms, in the selection of the medication, comorbidities and cardiovascular risk we discussed already, particularly with especially with this is salt load or sodium content. Important in the patient's comorbidities. Use of oral contraceptives also is key, because medications such as modafinil, pitolisant, and armodafinil interact with birth control. Adherence we touched on, really that is a key thing for any medication, and as we all know, polypharmacy is common as a result of the multiple symptoms, especially in a condition like narcolepsy. And a concurrent stimulant use was permitted in sodium oxybate, low sodium oxybate, and once nightly sodium oxybate trials.
In summary today, we have some specific goals that you can take away from this podcast. These are your SMART goals. These are specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely goals. So, number one, assess the current efficacy and quality of life impact of narcolepsy treatments for my patients in my practice. Use the latest clinical trial data to develop personalized treatment plans, considering novel therapies and how patient preferences or challenges may be addressed. And then finally, consider using multiple mechanisms of action for patient symptoms in narcolepsy. Thank you for this excellent discussion today, Clete. Our talk today lays the foundation for episode 3, where we will hear from patients on their experiences with narcolepsy and use case-based examples to create individualized and patient-centered narcolepsy treatment plans. Please also don't forget to check out episode 1 if this is where you started. That's where we discuss more regarding the narcolepsy diagnosis. Thanks so much, Clete.
Thank you, Anne-Marie.
All 3 episodes and a wide variety of education resources are available on the CME Outfitters Sleep Disorders Education Hub for both healthcare providers and patients.